social policy and climate spending could prove to be the most innovative components of the party's domestic legislation, a top priority which was once envisioned as a transformative cradle-to-grave initiative to vault a stagnant working class into prosperity. Now, even as President Biden and his allies cut down the plan to ensure it can pass, even with Democrats' razor-thin edge in Congress, they are toiling to agree on new tax policies that could have far-reaching consequences. Among them is a measure Senate Democrats presented on Tuesday, 26th of October, that would impose a 15% minimum tax rate on corporations based on the profits they report to their shareholders, not what they show to the Internal Revenue Service, IRS. The billionaires' tax and the corporate minimum tax face skepticism among House Democrats, who questioned their feasibility, and both were likely to encounter legal and constitutional challenges. For the first time, billionaires would face a tax on the unrealized gains in the value of their liquid assets, such as stocks, bonds, and cash, which can grow for years as vast capital stores that can be borrowed off to live virtually income tax-free. The courts would have to determine whether unrealized gains in wealth can be considered income, which the 16th Amendment allows the federal government to tax. And even if they passed legal muster, the measures were all but certain to spawn fresh tax avoidance efforts. But with Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, a crucial holdout on President Biden's plan, serving as a one-woman blockade against more conventional tax rate increases, Democrats appear to have no choice but to turn to creative revenue measures. I've always felt that success was giving everybody in America the chance to get ahead, and what we're dealing with here are flagrant loopholes in the tax code, said Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon and chairman of the Finance Committee. They're legal, but I'm going to close them. Democratic leaders unveiled a final bill on Wednesday, 27th of October, hoping that it would pass the House and Senate, but several sticking points remained. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, seemed to torpedo a plan that would require banks to provide the IRS with more customer account information to help catch tax cheats, calling the idea screwed up and declaring it cannot happen. Dropping it would mean that Democrats would have to find another way to raise hundreds of billions of dollars the provision was estimated to generate. Senator Kyrsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, was trying to line up support, including from Senator Manchin, to beef up a federally paid family and medical leave provision that had been whittled down to just 4 weeks from 12. Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat of Georgia, threatened to withdraw his support for the bill if, as expected, it dropped a provision that would expand health care coverage for the working poor in a dozen states like his that have refused to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, was still furious over the refusal of a handful of Democrats to give Medicare board powers to negotiate prescription drug prices. But overall, liberal Democrats were trying to make their peace with a stripped-down bill that would turn a once expansive vision for social transformation into a series of short-term measures, many of which would expire under a Republican Congress if history holds and the president's party loses seats in next year's midterm elections. I'd rather we put programs out there, and if people like them, then we should continue them as a government. And if for some reason they're not popular, well then, that also helps make some determinations, said Representative Mark Pocan, Democrat of Wisconsin and a leader of the Progressive House Democrats. Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington and the head of the Progressive Caucus, struck a pragmatic note. She said, "Look, the thing is, we would have been done with a very different bill a month ago if we only needed 90% of us, but that's not the case. We need 100% of us." Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, acknowledged that the package would not contain everything that President Biden wanted. But she said the alternative to what is being negotiated is not the original package. It is nothing. Democratic leaders continue to frame the legislation as transformational, an heir to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. They lumped in its $1.5 trillion in spending with the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid bill that passed last spring and a pending $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure measure awaiting passage in the House. "We're hopeful and we're optimistic about the prospects of delivering something historic, transformative, and bigger than one could possibly have imagined on behalf of everyday Americans," Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, declared on Tuesday. Ms. Jayapal said not all the provisions had been truncated. Child care subsidies should last 6 years and home and community-based health care assistance could stretch even longer. But other measures have been cut. 2 years of guaranteed community college were jettisoned. A broad path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants was knocked out by the Senate parliamentarian. So Democratic leaders were trying to win approval to grant temporary legal status to some undocumented immigrants. An expansion of Medicare coverage to include dental, vision, and hearing care appeared likely to be cut back, if not eliminated altogether. So Senator Bernie Sanders was pushing for a $1,000 debit card as a bridge to a permanent program, particularly for dental benefits. A permanent extension of the generous child tax credit created for a year in March's pandemic relief bill was to be extended only another year. That left the tax increases that Democrats were cobbling together on the fly as potentially the most far-reaching aspect of the plan. Senator Kyrsten Sinema's refusal to accept conventional tax rate increases has played into the hands of Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts and a longtime proponent of creative measures to break through the tax avoidance strategies of the rich. "These problems cannot be fixed by raising tax rates," she said. The corporate minimum tax, for instance, plays off Elizabeth Warren's long-standing efforts to force companies to pay taxes off the profits they boast about to shareholders, rather than those they minimize for tax-paying purposes. The minimum tax unveiled on Tuesday was something of a substitute for initial efforts blocked by Kyrsten Sinema to raise the corporate income tax rate to at least 25% from 21%, still far lower than the 35% rate paid before President Donald Trump's 2017 tax cut. Under the plan, companies with at least $1 billion in profits, about 200 publicly traded corporations, would no longer be able to escape income tax altogether. The 15% minimum tax would also bring the United States into compliance with the standard recently set by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, to try to root out tax havens. Senate Finance Committee aides singled out Amazon, which over the last 3 years reported $45 billion in profit, including a record $20 billion last year, but paid an effective tax rate of just 4.3%. In 2018, they said Amazon did not pay any federal income tax. Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, estimated the minimum tax would raise $300 billion to $400 billion over 10 years. Importantly, Kirsten Sinema blessed it as a common-sense step towards ensuring that highly profitable corporations pay a reasonable minimum corporate tax on their profits. The details of the billionaire's tax were being hammered out on Tuesday night. Under the plan, Congress would impose a one-time tax on all gains in the value of tradable assets held by billionaires from the time they were initially purchased. That first hit would be huge, since men like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Elon Musk of Tesla, and Jeff Bezos of Amazon sit on vast shares of the companies they created, which initially had a value of zero. After that, anybody with $1 billion in assets or who received $100 million in earnings for three consecutive years would face an annual tax on the gains in value of their publicly traded assets, whether or not they were sold.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. An initiative by the late founder of Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, the arrival of this Unity Week, as its title suggests, serves as a big opportunity for Muslims to once again return to the main teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, such as strengthening unity among Muslims. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, he has PhD on Islamic science.
Imam Khomeini, in regards to the unity, has mentioned that in Islam it is this fraternity that is the source of blessing. And we know that this brotherhood or fraternity, it is the main source of blessing. There are many narrations that we have in Islam which talks about the brotherhood, which talks about the groups and gathering and being united, and this unity is the main source of blessing. And we know that there are many examples, even if we are not talking about Islam, if we generally talk, obviously the blessing is where the people are united. If people are in disputes, then obviously there is an oppression, there is injustice. But if people are united, then no one can oppress them. Then oppressors do not have the courage to oppress them if the people are united. Therefore, we can also see that when the enemies of Islam want to attack Islam, the very first thing which they do is to bring dispute amongst the people.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala.
There is a famous statement of the British government, which they applied in the Indo-Pak, which they applied in the places where they used to attack, and they used to obviously overtake or they used to invade countries through this rule, this statement, and that was divide and rule. Means that divide people into small groups, and when they're divided, obviously, they will not have unity. When they do not have unity, it is easy to basically rule over them. So this divide and rule statement, or the slogan, which was for some countries, they are still applying those, we can say, like these rules in today's world as well. Therefore, we Muslims, we need to be careful. And that's why Imam Khomeini has said that in Islam, it is the fraternity that is the source of blessing. It is the unity that is the source of blessing. If Muslims are united, then the enemies cannot damage the Muslim Ummah. And if Muslim Ummah get united, Allah will send more blessings upon them, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
Every year, hundreds of Americans lose their lives due to violence and shooting. Estimates show that more than 90% of crimes is committed by men. Crimes from mass shooting to murder, armed robbery, and rape. But what is the reason behind this overwhelming amount of violence in American society? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Perhaps to understand the culture of violent masculinity in America, one must look into the myth that being a real man means putting up a false front and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Stay with us as in this episode of Aperture, Tough Guys provides a stunning look at the violence boys and young men routinely receive from virtually every corner of the American culture. From television, movies, video games, advertising, the sports culture, and U.S. political culture. Don't go away.
The deadliest mass shooting in American history.
They were just joining us. Two young men, apparently dressed in long black trench coats, opened fire at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
When it comes to violence, it's almost like there are two Americas.
It's horrific. I can't even put it, you can't put it into words.
There's the America that recoils in horror whenever a brutal mass shooting erupts onto our television screens, shocked by the level of destruction and suffering that just a few individuals are capable of visiting upon so many innocent people.
Police say that the gunman opened fire in a theater during a showing of that latest Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises.
And then there's the America that can't seem to get enough of violence as a form of entertainment and ritual, a seemingly endless appetite for ever-intensifying spectacles of all-out brutality and carnage. The question is what sort of relationship, if any, these two Americas have to one another. And if we're serious about answering that question, we need to stop chasing symptoms and take a good look at a truth that's been hiding in plain sight all along. That when we talk about violence in America, whether it's real or imaginary, we're almost always talking about violent masculinity. I'm Jackson Katz, and for more than 25 years, I've worked on both a personal and an institutional level to engage men directly in the effort to prevent men's violence against women and children. The reason I work with and focus on men is simple, because for the most part, violence is a men's issue. The statistics tell the story. 86% of armed robberies are committed by men. 77% of aggravated assaults are committed by men. 87% of stalkers are men. 86% of domestic violence incidents resulting in physical injury are perpetrated by men. 99% of rapes are committed by men. Men commit approximately 90% of murder. And over the past 30 years, 61 of the last 62 mass shootings have been committed by men. But while these numbers are striking, they rarely, if ever, come into play in mainstream discussions about violence.
After every event like this, the questions always are the same. What causes this kind of a shooting? How can this happen? How can they be stopped?
During hours and hours of exhaustive reporting, commentators seem to go out of their way to find gender-neutral ways to talk about this violence.
The shooters in Aurora, the shooters in Newtown,
the Connecticut shooter,
the Aurora shooter,
the alleged shooter, teenage psychopath,
mass murderers,
the suspect,
that kid,
this punk,
this murderer.
The male perpetrators become shooters or murderers or assailants or killers or suspects or psychopaths.
It's kids killing kids in the heart of America.
Violence committed by boys becomes kids killing kids and youth violence.
Here is a revealing and frankly horrifying picture of youth violence in America.
It doesn't seem to matter that girls are kids and youths too, but only commit a fraction of these kinds of crimes. And this baseline failure to acknowledge gender has a big effect when the discussion turns to other supposed causes of violence.
Violence in the entertainment culture.
Bloody games, gory movies, brutal TV shows.
Call of Duty or Halo.
Mental health issues, the faith issues.
Autism or Asperger's syndrome.
You're blaming the gun.
Their mom and their dad.
Substance abuse.
Mental health, violent games, violent movies.
I want to blame
Alex.
The real culprit.
Alex.
Suicide pills.
Alex.
Mass murder pills.
We hear very little, if anything, about why it is that girls and women also live in a culture saturated associated with guns and media violence, also suffer from mental illness, also come from dysfunctional families and have substance abuse problems, yet don't commit anywhere near the amount of violence boys and men do. In other cases, the perpetrators disappear altogether.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
You see this a lot in the mainstream discussion about so-called violence against women. The fact that men are responsible for somewhere around 98% of this violence simply evaporates. We hear about women being harassed, abused, assaulted, or raped. Men are nowhere to be found. And the result of all this is that instead of seeing men's violence against women as a men's issue, we see it as a women's issue and focus most of our attention on how to help victims and survivors after the fact. A failure all the more glaring given that mainstream media outlets have no problem at all taking gender seriously when women are the ones doing the violence.
Teenage girls involved in violent fights.
A fight between two young girls breaks out on the playground.
More and more teenage girls are getting involved in violent fights.
When girls and women act out violently, their gender becomes the story. The same way race becomes the story with men of color.
The horrific murder rate in Chicago. Does it have to do with guns or race?
When men of color rape women or shoot people or blow things up, race and culture move to the forefront of the story, crowding out the fact that the vast majority of the perpetrators under consideration, no matter what color they are men. All of this is partly a function of how dominant ideologies work linguistically to conceal the power of dominant groups. For example, when we hear the word race in the United States, we tend immediately to think about African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, South Asians. And when we hear the term gender, we tend to think of women. In each case, the dominant group, white people, men, don't get examined. As if white people don't belong to some racial grouping, as if men don't have a gender. In other words, we always focus on the subordinated group and not on the dominant one. And that's one of the ways that the power of dominant groups isn't questioned. By remaining invisible.
There are young men involved in these things. There's a lot of testosterone there.
And on those rare occasions when the subject of men does make its way into mainstream discussions about violence, there's this common refrain that men's violence is all about testosterone and our prehistoric role as hunter-warriors. We're just programmed to be violent.
What is it about the testosterone of being a young man that makes this come to this gun violence head so often?
Why does it seem that these mass shooters are boys? And not girls.
Really, it goes back to hunter-gatherer days.
Yeah. You hear another version of this in the common refrain, boys will be boys.
Let boys be boys. They want to play rough. Don't try and over-medicate them and, you know, turn them into girls. They're boys.
No one would deny that there are biological factors that sometimes come into play with violence. The problem is when biological arguments lead people to conclude that men are just beasts who are overcome by hormonal urges they can't control, that men are incapable of making moral and ethical decisions, that boys are born hardwired to bully, rape, and murder. But perhaps the most damaging thing this kind of thinking does is that it blinds us to the fundamental role that cultural systems play in all of this.
This is a document signed by six of the major public health organizations saying that the violence and the entertainment, the level that we've attained to today, is causing increased aggressive behavior among some children.
For decades, experts and government officials have been arguing that we need to take a closer look at the relationship between violence in the culture and violence in the real world.
And in the days since the heartbreaking tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, I also tasked the vice president with leading an effort to come up with a comprehensive set of serious proposals to keep our children safe, including strengthening school safety, improving mental health care, and addressing a culture that too often glorifies guns and violence.
This focus on the culture of violence in America took on new and bipartisan urgency in the wake of Adam Lanza's cold-blooded murder of 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. But unfortunately, it quickly descended into a distracting and false debate between defenders of the gun industry and defenders of the entertainment industry.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people through vicious, violent video games.
On one side, we've had the gun industry blaming movies and video games.
We have blood-soaked films out there, like American Psycho, Natural Born Killers, that are aired like propaganda loops on splatter days and every single day.
On the other side of the debate, we've had the entertainment industry blaming the NRA and guns.
Can we not do a better job on controlling the weapons of violence that get to the wrong hands?
What both sides have failed to mention is how for years they've been mutually reinforcing parts of the same culture of violence and have profited handsomely from one another. And the reason this matters so much is that while we've been debating whether guns or movies and video games are more to blame for violence, we've missed what the culture teaches boys about what it means to be a man. We often talk about violence being a learned behavior, but it's more to the point to say that it's a taught behavior. And by shifting the focus from learned to taught, we shift the onus of responsibility onto those of us who are teaching our sons what it means to be a man. Since the 1970s, sociologists and other researchers have identified a consistent set of messages the culture sends boys about what it means to be a real man. William Pollack introduced the idea of a boy code in which boys are taught from a very early age to act tough and not show their feelings. Michael Kimmel extended the reach of the boy code into late adolescence and young adulthood, where he describes a guy code in which young men police each other into conformity with dictates about manhood that come with an implicit and sometimes explicit warning. Don't slip up or you risk being unmasked and found out as someone who doesn't measure up. The result is that guys are put into a box that turns out to be the perfect breeding ground for violence. We can't show any emotion except anger. We can't think too much or seem too intellectual. We can't back down when someone disrespects us. We have to show we're tough enough to inflict physical pain and take it in turn. We're supposed to be sexually aggressive with women. Anything short of full-scale emotional shutdown becomes a source of humiliation and shame. And in response, young men learn to adopt what I call the tough guys, the front so many young men put up to shield their vulnerabilities and avoid being ridiculed. But it doesn't just come from their peer groups. It comes from fathers, coaches, and older male role models as well. Eastwood's character, like so many fathers, father figures, coaches, and other men in boys' lives, assumes the role of the director and proceeds to evaluate how well the young man performs his role. It doesn't matter how unnatural, complicated, or ridiculous the role is, boys are expected to learn their lines and master the tough guys, or else risk being shamed as less than a man. A pair of animated films show very clearly how this process is passed down intergenerationally.
Lenny, you see something, you kill it, you eat it, period. Thanks. That's what sharks do. That's a fine tradition. What's the matter with you?
Right here in front of me now, eat this.
In Shark Tale, the father shark makes it clear to his son, who is a vegetarian, that he has no choice but to conform to shark norms and become carnivorous and aggressive.
Frankie, I want you to take Lenny out, show him the ropes.
Oh, come on, Pop.
Son, you're gonna learn how to be a shark, whether you like it or not.
I'm gonna kill you, dragon.
Similarly, in How to Train Your Dragon, the son of a Viking leader runs into problems when he refuses to act violently. And the unwillingness of the boy to use violence causes a crisis in his relationship with his warrior father.
I don't want to fight dragons.
Come on, yes you do.
Who can't even comprehend that his son might not want to follow in his violent footsteps. Qualities like compassion, caring, empathy, intellectual curiosity, fear, vulnerability, even love, basic human qualities that boys have inside them every bit as much as girls do, get methodically driven out of them by a sexist culture that labels these things unmanly, feminine, womanly, and teaches boys to avoid them at all costs. And, most importantly, they're taught that real men turn to violence not as a last resort, but as the go-to method of resolving disputes. And also as the primary means of winning respect and establishing masculine credibility.
Good morning. This is Randy Pion on KRES Radio, the voice of the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation.
In the groundbreaking film Smoke Signals, one of the first features produced by Native Americans, there's a memorable scene where an older kid tries to teach a younger kid how to be a real-life Hollywood Indian. The scene is funny, but it also shows how the pressure to conform to ideals of violent masculinity cuts across racial, ethnic, and class lines. As the sociologist Richard Majors has pointed out, African-American and other men of color in urban areas often adopt a hyper-masculine, menacing persona he calls the cool pose to signal that they're still men, regardless of what else has been stripped from them. This is also true with Latino men.
Checkmate, bufo.
Who are disproportionately portrayed in Hollywood as gangbangers, Mexican drug lords, and thugs in the barrio. Images that are crude stereotypes, but which nonetheless have become symbols of toughness to some poor and working class Latinos whose manhood has been undermined by class exploitation and ethnic discrimination. And we see the same thing when it comes to Asian masculinity. In American popular culture, Asian men have long been emasculated, stereotyped as ineffectual, desexualized, and unmanly. But since the early 1970s, running counter to this long line of neutered stereotypes is the highly stylized physicality and violence of the martial arts. But young Asian American men don't just have to look to Bruce Lee for cues. Increasingly, we've seen the phenomenon of Asian guys adopting the tough guy street styles of African American and Latino men to establish their masculine credentials. Middle-class white boys may not have a lot of experience with the kind of real-world inner-city conditions that gave rise to the cool pose, but the culture tells them if they take on this black, urban, hard guy pose, they'll somehow be more real, more of a man. What makes this even more interesting is that a lot of the very guys they see as models of authenticity are themselves projecting an image they picked up from the culture. As the writer Nathan McCall has said, he and some of his African-American male cohorts got some of their ideas of manhood from The Godfather and other gangster films that featured tough, ruthless, white Italian gangsters. And the same kind of thing about Scarface.
It's one of the hottest movies ever made.
This is the all-time greatest movie.
Never seen nothing like that. I watched this movie 63 times.
It's a comic book. So we have this interesting phenomenon where we have white middle-class males emulating poor urban black males who in turn are getting part of their idea about manhood from gangster films featuring white men who are playing Italian and Cuban-American gangsters.
Now are we made or are we made, man?
The paradox is that the test of being real somehow comes down to how well you live up to a made-up script. And it's a script that's only become increasingly violent over time. The American ideal of the real man owes a lot to the Hollywood Western and the ultimate icon of white American masculinity, John Wayne.
Young fella, if you're looking for trouble, I'll accommodate you.
While other men talked a lot, thought too much, equivocated, and showed emotion, John Wayne made the world bend to his will with just a stare, a few words, his fists, and his guns.
I haven't lost my temper in 40 years, but Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed, and somebody ought to belt you in the mouth. But I won't.
And then there's Hollywood gangster films with cinematic tough guys like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart.
Don't move out of you, son. I'll fill your pants full of lead. Get over there.
Men hardened by the world who knew the power of a few clipped words and a few rounds of ammunition. And this equation between toughness, manhood, and violence has continued and in many ways intensified over time. There's no question that over the past few decades, there's been a ratcheting up of what it takes to be considered a real man. Our action heroes. In the 1950s, Superman was the equivalent of an ordinary guy running around in tights and a cape. And today, he's pumped up and ripped. Well, Batman. The body of Adam West as Batman in the 1960s is a far cry from the far more imposing Dark Knight of the 21st century. Pro wrestlers' bodies in the 1960s were more flabby. In the 21st century, they're way more sculpted, pumped up, and ripped. And look at toy action figures. If you look at the Star Wars toy figurines that kids played with in the 1970s and contrast them with the Star Wars toy figurines that are being marketed to kids today, you see a dramatic shift. Well, the body of G.I. Joe. A study done in the late 1990s found that over the past 50 years, the size of G.I. Joe's biceps in real-life equivalents increased from 12.2 inches in 1964 to 15.2 inches in 1974 to 16.4 inches in 1994 and up to 26.8 inches by 1998. If you wanted a comparison to a real person, the biceps of someone like The Rock are reportedly only about 20 inches. We can see a similar pattern in the changing level of violence itself over time. We've gone from pistols in the 1940s to larger weaponry in the 1970s to the increasing militarization of these weapons in the 80s and 90s to the larger-than-life heavy metal killing machines we have today. We've seen video game violence go from the benign aggressions of Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and Asteroids to the unimaginable and hyper-realistic bloodbaths of today's game.
Get on me!
We've gone from the comparatively orderly sport of boxing to today's number one fighting sport, the street fighting viciousness of mixed martial arts and cage fighting. Now, there's no doubt we're in the throes of some kind of a crisis in masculinity. But rather than questioning whether it's our inability to move beyond the straitjacket of traditional masculinity that might be the source of this crisis, across the cultural and political landscape, there's been a growing movement to reclaim and reassert traditional manhood.
We need to toughen up and stand up for ourselves and learn to be a lot tougher than yoga is going to teach us to do all by ourselves.
The basic idea is that men are in crisis because women have been waging a full-scale war on traditional manhood.
We've been so emasculated by a so-called women's movement at this point. Even our strongest men are acting girly.
The whole culture is being feminized, in my opinion.
There's a certain emasculation that's happening in our culture.
Part of the problem is we've sort of feminized schools.
I think she's right. It's 100%. We're wussifying America.
Is this the wussification of America?
Yes, this is. One more. more step in the wussification of America.
Is this the latest in the wussification of America?
The result is a narrative that tells men that the best way to respond to change is not to adapt, but to reclaim traditional masculine control and dominance from the forces of feminization.
The founding fathers were men, not wussies. It's the wussification of America that's killing us.
And as it turns out, this is an old pattern in American history. Take the Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouting is one of the few institutions to balance the rather softening effect of our modern way of life.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum and Sayyid
Mohsen. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. So recently, in two Friday Jummah prayers in Afghanistan, there have been two bomb blasts, you know, terrorist bomb attacks by the suicide bombers. One of them, which took place first, was in Kunduz, and the other one in Bibi Fatima Mosque in Kandahar. You know, up to now, more than 120 people have been killed in these two incidents, and the Daesh terrorist groups, you know, claim the responsibility of these bombings in these two Shia mosques. But before that, we had these suicide bombing in front of the Sayyid al-Shuhada school, the girls' school in Afghanistan. Really a very sad news, and this attacking of the Afghanistan's Shia's minority has a long history. Sayyid Murtaza, let's start with you, brother. It seems that whoever is the administration, the Shia's minority, are under the attack of these groups over there and are the victims, isn't it so?
Well, of course, yes. You know, in the past at least 25 years, the Shiite minorities all over the country have been attacked deliberately and on purpose. Many analysts have brought some justifications. They have mentioned that Shiite minority is the primary target for terrorist groups such as Daesh, and previously Taliban themselves,
yes,
attacked, you know, carried out such a deadly attacks on Shiite sites. Unfortunately, Shiite minority have not been considered as one important segment of the Afghan society. They have been treated like marginalized people and marginalized groups. Even Shiite political parties,
yes,
have not been given the first primary attention by the ex-government in Afghanistan.
Yes.
So terrorist groups, in order to prove and confirm their strong presence on the ground, they look for a very swift, easy targets.
No.
And Shiite minorities are the one they are after.
Why is it so? Why so swift, you know, and easy to target?
Unfortunately, you know, in order to have a strong presence in the political system in the country, you need to have some representatives. And Shiite minorities, unfortunately, have not had such a tool in order to prove that they have had so far the strong presence.
Yes.
So terrorist groups look for the easy targets, and unfortunately, these mosques, madrasas, schools, any gathering sites belong to Shiite groups have been attacked over the past 25 years.
Right.
And even the American themselves took many Shiite people as their hostages when they were just carrying out those night attacks across the country. So we can simply see that Shiites have been the primary target for all terrorist groups and the ex-government officials, just to show that there is a kind of absolute majority of the Sunni's government.
That's
and they are not going to consider other minorities as as part of the society and the political system.
That's all right. So thank you, Said Mohsen. So Said Mohsen, what would be the solution to this problem? I mean, aren't they going to recognize the Shiite groups and the Shiite minority as a legitimate group who are living in Afghanistan for so many years? I think they are called by the name of Hazara?
Well, you know, there are many different races with ethnicities, living in Afghanistan. Hazaras is one of them. But mostly Shiite, are coming from the Hazara ethnicities.
Yes, that's right. So what would be the solution to this problem, you know? And so many people are killed nowadays. The children, look at the girls, you know, the innocent girls that has been killed inside the Shahada school for the bomb attacks, Kunduz and Kandahar, and the media coverage in Afghanistan has always been, you know, on the
biased.
Top. Yeah, the bias, you know. They say nowadays that the Shias have been bombed or this and that. We have never heard that the Sunni gathering is bombed in Afghanistan. It's really strange news. So what's happening, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously we know that in Islam, the enemies always wanted to inject some propagandas, and the takfirism is one of them.
Yes.
Takfirism means like you claim another group which is not same as you, being kafir or disbelievers.
Okay.
And since in Afghanistan, obviously, the religious groups who are in Afghanistan, especially the Talib or Taliban, they belong to the Islamic seminaries of Ahl Sunnah, and not just Ahl Sunnah, because within Ahl Sunnah we have different categories.
Yes.
There are different school of thoughts. One of them, which is the extremist groups, they're known as the Wahhabis and Murtafiris.
Yes.
We can see, like, initially when against Russia, when they came, the Soviet Union,
yes,
when Taliban entered into the Afghanistan at the time of Ziaul Haq, when he was the chief in Pakistan or the general in Pakistan. At that time, the Islamic seminaries who belonged to the Takfiri school of thought, especially Wahhabism or the Saudi, we can say, backed Islamic seminaries, who considered Shias as kafir, they entered the Afghanistan. And they had, obviously, when they entered Afghanistan, they started to root their own ideologies within the Afghan Taliban, the Afghan, we can say, Islamic seminary schools. Even before that, yes, we can see there was killing of Shias, but obviously it was two-way. They used to protect each other because, you know, when you go towards the borderline of the northern area of Pakistan, where it's Peshawar, and then we have the border of Afghanistan. There also we can see there's a dispute between the Shia and Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from before.
Yes.
But obviously this thing has blamed up, and obviously the things has grown. We can say like the weapons and the accessories were given to the Taliban.
That's right.
And then obviously Shia got weakened and weakened.
Yes.
And the point which brother has raised, that's true. Like, in order to show your power, you look for the weak ones.
Yes.
And you always beat the weak ones. So when we talk about the solution is obviously we need to change. There must be a change of mentality because, you know, if Taliban claims to follow the Quran, if they claim to follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, then obviously even if the minorities which you think they are non-believers, there is a protection for them in your country. You know, in Islam we have the rule of jizya.
Yes.
I'm just talking, I'm not saying like the Shias are the kafir or disbelievers, I'm not saying this. I'm talking on the grounds of the Quran, that the Quran has introduced jizya for the non-believers.
Even non-believers they will give, have rights, that's right. Okay.
They have the rights, and the ruler of the country should protect them.
Okay.
So this is what we see. Even at the time of the Prophet, when we look at the history, Prophet did not kill the Jews or non-Muslims in Medina. Okay.
Yes.
When he was in the Mecca, he never raised his sword against the non-believers. He, with his wordings, has called them towards the true Islam. So, you know, there are the, basically, it depends, and it is depending on their beliefs which they have.
That's right.
So,
but obviously, the story now is different because The Taliban has got the power, you know. The Taliban used to bomb attack the Shia mosque before. Now they have the power, and they see these bomb attacks from the time of ISIS, from the side of ISIS, okay? And really, one of the spokesmen called ISIS, you know, not a threat, but a headache. It means there are so many commonalities and similarities between the two. But I think the Taliban, if they want to have the power in Afghanistan, they have to recognize the Shia minority as a legitimate group, isn't it?
Well, actually, in order to have stability in the country, Taliban now is in control of the country.
Yes.
They have to consider a lasting, inclusive, and actually political settlement of the issues. Otherwise, this clash will go on for another 20 years, 30 years, because even minority groups such as Shiites have access to all types of weapons. So now it's like Shiites are waiting to see how Taliban are going to rule the country.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is not going to be stopped, and if this is not going to be considered by Taliban as a threat to other minority groups, I think in very near future we will have some kind of uprising across the country.
That's
so
right.
It is for Taliban to think how they can provide protection to minority groups such as Shiites. So I think the lasting stability of the country all goes back how Taliban is going to form and construct their policies towards and against groups.
And do they believe at all in the official settlement? I mean, like the other countries have, like a parliament or having ministries or something like that?
Well, I've just listened to an interview a couple of days ago. Because many other countries demanded Taliban to form an inclusive government.
Yes.
The response to such an international request, Taliban said, well, we will have a government and we will have members from all ethnicities in our government system. But international community should not ask us for an inclusive government.
Mm-hmm.
So this statement is a very strong statement.
Okay.
It means that they are going to construct a government based on their own ideologies, based on their beliefs,
yes,
and they are not going to follow modern way of ruling the country.
That's
like
right.
Any other parts of the world.
That's all right. And really, it makes more clear the strategic failure of the U.S. because 20 years ago, after these 9/11 attacks in the U.S., they claimed that we want to attack terrorism in Afghanistan and Iraq. So one of their targets was Taliban, for sure. Is it so? So after 20 years, now the Taliban is ruling and Americans. So what does it mean? I don't understand.
Well, of course, we all know the fact on the ground sometimes looks very much different from the general picture. The principles.
Yes.
America went into Afghanistan to fight Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
Because 9/11 was a strategic event that took place in the recent history of America.
Yes.
So they went there to take out Al-Qaeda. And besides, Taliban were involved.
Yes.
So now after 20 years, America can see that their first target was not achieved.
Mm-hmm.
They lost a lot. They are still losing. No one is going to trust America any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Afghan nation is the biggest loser.
Loser and victim, that's right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's all right. So
I can just add something about the history as well. We should not forget the role of British and America.
Mm-hmm.
In the Shia killings in Afghanistan or Pakistan or any place in the world. Why? Because we know that the Ali Saud was made by the Britishers. They have backed them up. And what I can remember, like in the initial war against the Soviet Union, these Taliban groups in the Pakistan, obviously, they were also backed up by the Saudi Arabia.
That's all right.
And you know that the Saudi Arabia has a takfiri, like thinking and
yes,
killing.
Yes.
Even the Al-Qaeda members, which were nominated by the Americans, most of them were the Saudi Arabian nationals. And we know that, obviously, this takfirism, this killing and the thoughts has come from Saudi Arabia. If I can just refer to the history, we can see, like in Pakistan, there was a peace until the Taliban was obviously their race. And the Sunni used to marry Shia, and the Shia used to marry Sunnis. There are many examples in Pakistan. But since this thing has started, the things of Taliban, the whole situation changed. And now we can see, that the Shias were killed in even in Pakistan by the the Al-Qaeda groups or Daesh or even the Pakistani Taliban. Oh. You know, in Pakistan today, we have many people who claim to be the Pakistani Taliban. For example, in Islamabad, there is a mosque whose imam is the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, because now they're in two different groups, like Pakistani Taliban and Afghanistani Taliban. And this guy has given a statement that in the month of Muharram, because Taliban has provided some protection to the processions of the Shias for their own ceremonies, they were against it, the Taliban in Pakistan. Oh. So we can see, like, this Takfiri thought, which is backed by the Saudi Arabia, you can see it highly on a high level in Pakistan and at a low level now when Taliban is in power.
Yes.
That's the only difference, a low level.
Yeah, but they will face many questions and ambiguities now because they've got a power.
Well, let me just add to my brother's opinion. You know, Taliban actually didn't fight Soviet Union war in Afghanistan. Some of the Taliban members were called Mujahideens, and they were freedom fighters.
Yes.
But during the Soviet war in Afghanistan, there was no group by the name of Taliban. So Taliban was created around 1994, I think, by the financial help of Saudi Arabia and the logistic help from Pakistan and the American, actually, policy. So all these three countries came together to create a group that can actually protect their benefits and rights.
That's all right.
So Taliban actually didn't have a presence in the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And you do know that the only solution to the current situation in Afghanistan is the recognition of peace agreement among all political national groups in Afghanistan.
That's
Taliban
right.
is in charge, but Taliban knows very well by heart that they cannot rule the country alone. They need to form and reform and restructure their own institutions in order to give a chance to peace to be established.
I
think Taliban for sure knows that the situation will differ in future.
We will talk more about the Taliban and the Taliban's behavior. Is it really changed? In upcoming session of the program, that's all we have time for today's discussion. Said Murtaza, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Said Mohsen.
You're welcome.
Dear brothers and sisters, thank you much for listening to us. This is Real Points. I am Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Khan of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Khan of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fiamanat.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature.
IRIB English Radio.